Mr. McGee.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Carianis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. How are you, Dean?
I am good, and I've really been excited to do this one, as you know.
Yes. Today, gang, we're talking about the Coventry Blitz, which is, if you don't know, one of the most devastating bombings of World War II. And the conspiracy theories about this are plentiful, more than you might imagine. And actually, we're living today in 2013 in conspiracy theory hell.
Sure.
This one makes us angry. This one makes Dean apoplectic, which doesn't sound as good for the Apoplectic History Podcast. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, here's what happened. Some people claim that Prime Minister Winston Churchill let the city of Coventry burn to draw America into the war, or to protect Britain's most closely guarded secret, Ultra. That was the intel collected by the cracking of the German Enigma code.
Right. And this conspiracy, as you said, really, really makes me angry. I'm afraid I might have to bleep myself to preserve our rating on iTunes. That's how upset it makes me.
I didn't even know that was a concern. So much for my awesome curse words of American presidents podcast I was going to do.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this f***ing wall.
But you have a more personal connection to this war than a lot of people do. Your mom was a child of this war in London. Yep. Tell us more about that.
She was in London, yeah. And I was actually, just this weekend, I mentioned to her that I was studying up on this and talking to some of the great people at the Churchill Center about it. And she said, oh, you know, I remember in London watching the bombs fall across the street. And I'd heard that from her before about her father's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
One day, relative not going to work and having the restaurant get firebombed that day. And it still strikes me. I mean, you know, it's your mother. You think, gosh, if history had gone a little differently, you wouldn't have been here.
Right.
And just, you know, it's something that sticks with you. And she's older now, obviously. And so when I think of people like her having their emotions preyed on and being lied to, basically, so people can sell books and sell tickets to plays, as we'll hear about,
right,
it really upsets me because, you know, Churchill wasn't perfect. Nobody is. But he was a great man and a good man. And there's not only no basis factually for this conspiracy theory, but it doesn't really make any sense, as we'll get into.
Okay, so with that being said, let's lay out these facts that the conspiracy folks seem to agree on. On November 14th of 1940, the Luftwaffe launched a bombing mission, and it was codenamed Moonlight Sonata. Now, when it was over, the city of Coventry lay in ruins, and was 568, I think, were confirmed dead. More died in the firestorm that followed, so you really can't get an exact body count. Now, the devastation led Joseph Goebbels, Nazi propaganda minister, to coin a new word for the total annihilation of a city, and that was Coventried, which is sensitive.
Yeah, that was a big win for the Nazis, which is one reason why I think it really puts the lie to the fact that Churchill would have wanted this to happen. Far from convincing the Americans to come into the war, it made it look like Britain was falling apart and that the Germans were unstoppable. And it also was a big hit to the British morale.
Yeah.
Now, I talked about my mom being there, and I have a clip here from Amy Woolley, who was 18 on November 14th when fire rained down from the sky, courtesy of Adolf Hitler.
That night, it was just as though the German bombers was following us home. So from then on, we never went out again. We went to the shelters practically every night. My dad and me, we used to get ready, all our old clothes on, shut the dog in the cupboard, and we'd go down the shelter. That was every night of the week. We did that for weeks and weeks. And then the November Blitz, we were in the shelter. And it was like there's hundreds of planes going out. We stood outside watching them going over. The planes going over. And we kept saying, somebody's going to get it today. Somebody's going to get it. And of course, it was us. We got it.
The attack started at 7 p.m. and lasted through until morning, as the bombers, they would drop their payloads, fly back to France, load up, bomb again. The Air Ministry ordered those aerodromes bombed as soon as they learned the target, but it was too late at that point. Now, the estimate here, the Luftwaffe dropped this picture. A million pounds of explosives, 33,000 incendiary bombs, and dozens of parachute mines on the city that was home to a 250,000 people. And by targeting the water supply, the Germans made it impossible to fight the inferno. So you think about that. You know, homes, factories, and gosh, the beautiful 14th-century cathedral in Coventry all burned.
Yeah, it was just a very well-planned, very devastating raid with a lot of punch. And people were really terrified by it. And there was really no way to stop it, even if everybody had been scrambled at once. There just was no way to down planes. We're so used to seeing it now. People love to say over and over that it's a video game war. But we really do have capabilities today that they could only dream of there. And warflight was only very new. Mm-hmm. And the reason the Germans attacked on a moonlit night was because made the bomber's job easier, and it made the anti-aircraft gun and the balloons and the fighter's job harder. So it was a lot harder, and we just can't conceive of that. I was talking, as I said, to the people connected to the Churchill Center and some historians, and I was just trying to wrap my brain around it. You know, 100 RAF fighters go up, and they only two of them open fire, and they don't shoot down any bombers. And it just seems inconceivable today, but this was the technology of the time. And the anti-aircraft gunners, same thing. I mean, one bomber was shot down. All that defense, which, by the way, Churchill had strengthened a week before, all that defense, even if they'd had everybody in Britain trying to stop it, it just was really, really hard to stop this kind of attack.
And it's an interesting thing, too. I mean, the RAF wouldn't do what the Japanese would do, and they would fly a Zero into a bomber if they could, right? I mean, was the RAF, that was not a tactic that they used.
Yeah, I mean, if they could even see them. And, you know, when you look at those in those days, you know, they only had so many rounds in their planes. But as I said, they didn't even get to open fire. Only two of those 100 RAF planes. And they scrambled all they could, but it just wasn't possible. And they figured it out too late, as we'll prove here in a minute.
You had a story, right? It was about Jean Taylor, right? Tell me about this girl and her and what her 14th birthday was like.
Well, she was one of the people who was in the public shelters. And as we said before about my mom, she spent time down in the underground in London. And when I was a kid, she would say, oh, I had the dream again that I'm in the underground and looking for your dad and you and your two brothers, and I couldn't find you. And she was one of the children that Churchill, in his wisdom, sent up to the country of England. Like in the beginning of, if you remember, The Lion,
the Witch, and the... We stepped on each other there, folks. We're talking about Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the C.S. Lewis book. And if you do remember, it was a wartime distraction, that story, for these poor children who had to sort of fret and leave their homes to avoid the bombing of their home. So continue.
Yeah, my mom was lucky, by the way. She got a very nice family.
Good.
And so that was a positive about the war. But this lady, her quote is pretty typical of what the feeling is here, sort of this not knowing. And she said, quote, "The rumor was that they decided to sacrifice the few to save the many. No one has ever confirmed or denied that, and that says a lot," unquote. Well, I mean, I feel for this woman because she's been lied to and she's bought a lie. And imagine her sitting there in her dotage, you know, feeling like all these horrible things were because she wasn't as important as somebody else was. And it's just not the case. I mean, nobody's confirmed it because it didn't happen. And it's not only been denied, but it's been refuted. And there's very few absolutes in history. But I think in this one, you can't even conceive of a reason why Churchill would think this would be a good strategy.
Right.
It just doesn't really make any sense. And unfortunately, it keeps getting repeated. It was even in the otherwise great sci-fi show Babylon 5. It's mentioned by Bruce Boxleitner as an example. And it just didn't happen. But it gets out there and with the internet and catches on.
Right. And there's no malice behind it, at least in the case of say, popular entertainment like Babylon 5. It's just one of those things that has sort of floated throughout the years. But let's say, you know, the Coventry had been hit before.
Yeah.
You know, and it was hit after this. This was not a surprise attack like Pearl Harbor. Here's Coventry's Bill Ward. He was 9 years old at the time. And he describes his brush with death that night. Listen.
"There was a tremendous roar. And as we looked round, we saw a Heinkel 111 flying up Beak Avenue. And Mum grabbed us all into the hedge because we'd heard stories of German aircrew firing at civilians. This he didn't do. The plane must have only been about 500 foot. And it roared off up the street. And then there was this almighty crash. And the sky lit up in front of us. And this plane had dropped all its bombs on Wallace Road, Radford. And one of the kids who lived in that street next morning came to school. And he got blobs of white all over his hair. It had changed color.
Wow. The kid's hair actually turned white. It's like something out of Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, right.
And yet, I mean, I said this to my mom, and she was like, oh, yeah, they'd come out of the shelter in their hair. I was like, what? I just thought that was lazy writing by Stephen King. I didn't know that. I mean, that this and what got me to today, I was on the A train coming home preparing mm-hmm. to do this, and I was reading this and looked at one of the words, and I said, that kid went to school the next day.
That's the thing. That's insane.
I mean, you know, even right. when we were kids, you know, the 70s and 80s, man, if you had an excuse to stay home, you'd use it.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I lost at Wii or in television, and now I'm really upset. So can't do it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the city was being destroyed. And yeah, go to school the next day.
Yeah, sure. Here are your books and, you know, mind the rubble. And
right. How much of that sort of backbone do you think Churchill was responsible for? I mean, because you always hear, again, one of the popular things about the war is that, you know, he was the guy who galvanized them and pulled them together and allowed them, gave them the will to keep fighting in the face of all this. I mean, goodness, we didn't come to the war for another year and a month, for crying out loud.
Yeah, they're pretty exhausting. And he always said that the people always had the lion's heart and he just got to give the roar, which right. I thought was, you know, it tells you a little bit about him. He knew when to take the credit and tell you that he was a great man, and he knew when to give it to the people. And he, in fact, that's what he says on the balcony when the war is won. He comes out and he's, you know, he's wearing a hat that doesn't go with the suit and, you know.
Oh, the health ministry balcony when he's out
yeah,
there.
And, yeah. And he says, the first thing he says is, this is your victory.
Yes.
But at this point, it's early and he has to really bring these people along. And this, I was in Coventry 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So my wife has family there. And, you know, this really, it was breaking people. I mean, it brings you to the breaking point. You see a huge chunk of your city just get wiped out and there are yeah. bodies. And
I understand
you know,
that.
A firestorm whips through and people lose everything. And it was really devastating. And there's no way that it makes sense to think, well, letting a city get destroyed would rally my people, much less rally the Americans, who were already being told by Joseph Kennedy and others that, you know, Britain's not going to pull this off. The Germans are just too good. They're too strong. So that part of it about getting America into the war, I think if you, like most of those false quotes that we talked about in the President's Day show, mm-hmm. if you stop and think for a minute, you realize, well, that's not really a really smart strategy. And Churchill was smarter than any five guys that we know. You know, he would have thought right. of a better way to rally the people than letting this horrible, horrible thing happen.
All right. Dean, I've got to stop you right here. Don't wait for the translation. Tell me, you're a Churchill apologist. Why did he let this happen? No, seriously. Who started this theory, dude?
This theory was nowhere until a guy named, he was a group captain, F.W. Winterbotham. He even has a name that sounds made up, so I'm not surprised. But he published a book in 1974.
9 years after Churchill died.
Right. And 34 years after the Coventry bombing. Yeah. He, no primary sources, nothing written, wrote completely from memory. Churchill, as you said, is not alive to defend himself. And he claimed that the name Coventry had come through in clear type from a German message through the Enigma breaking, which was in its infancy at that point.
Right.
And already, it just doesn't make sense. The Germans weren't stupid. And at historiccoventry.co.uk, they write, quote, "Not only is it unlikely in the extreme that the Germans would be so lax with their coding, but R.V. Jones, the head of the scientific intelligence, and through whom all messages had to pass, states categorically that no message whatsoever was received that hinted at Coventry as the target. The British had decrypted the code name Moonlight Sonata, but that just led them to believe there was going to be an attack that, right. like a sonata, would be in three parts.
Clever.
Based on what the Germans had done before, they figured they'd drop flares. First wave of bomber drops flares. That way the second and third wave of bombers knows where the city is. They're really practicing all different kinds of technologies and strategies at this point to fool each other.
Right.
And so all the logical thinking was, oh, okay, that's what they're going to do. They're just going to come and do what they've done before, which makes sense.
Sure. Now, the Germans were not only communicating in German, as they're wont to do, but they're using code names throughout.
Yeah, I mean, there would be no sense for them to make Enigma and then just, you know, put over the wire, so we are going to bomb Coventry tonight.
Yes. Ready?
Yeah, it would just make no, I mean, why would they, and we'll hear from a German pilot later, but
right.
like, that wasn't the goal. This was a new strategy that they went out, and the name actually that came through, according to Terry Charman, the senior historian at the Imperial War Museum, was Korn, K-O-R-N.
Right.
Now, that's the kind of thing. Okay, even if you read that, you don't know what it means. There's no reason to think it might be Coventry. And they thought it referred to the Germans talking about how their screens would look when the British tried to jam their signals, their radar and their beams and whatnot. So they just made a mistake there. But there was nothing as clear as there never is. We see this with Pearl Harbor. We see it with the 9/11, all these conspiracy theories. Everybody is so sure that at the time, out of this sea of different people and intelligence, they would have been able to connect the dots. But it wasn't that clear.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
Okay.
Peter MacGyver wrote in the Churchill Center newsletter, Finest Hour, "There is not even the thinnest shred of truth in Group Captain Winterbotham's story of Coventry," end quote.
Okay.
I mean, there's nobody who comes forward with a document. There's nobody who comes forward with anything to back up this story. That's what, I mean, there's a ton of quotes that we have. We'll put these links on the website and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's just such overwhelming information on the other side. And even the three people who, all three of them selling books, by the way, who tried to push this conspiracy theory, none of, even their stories don't agree. They can't all be true. And there's just nothing to document it. And the strategy just doesn't make sense.
And while we're at it here too, Dean, I'm sorry to interrupt, but, you know, definitely go up, you know, if you're listening, go visit winstonchurchill.org. The Churchill Center is awesome. And they do really fine scholarly work, debunking quotes and myths about the man. We're both members, again, full disclosure.
Yeah, they are great. And there's a lot of myths about Churchill and a lot of things that people get wrong. And we want to get history right.
Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
German? Forget it, he's rolling.
It ain't over now!
Owen and I were talking about Bletchley Park and Bletchley Park Trust. You can go actually and see where these code breakers worked. And it was a huge complex, all in secrecy. And you can talk to some of the code breakers. They actually did a lot of work to try to save it.
Right.
They also have a podcast actually that you can follow that I was listening to some today.
Oh, cool.
And this is a quote from Simon Greenish, who's from Bletchley.
Bletchley had decoded a number of messages clearly indicating a major raid was going to happen in the near future. And the assumption was that it was going to be either Birmingham, Coventry, or London. But they didn't have enough information to establish which one.
And it's worth noting here, too, Dean, that Winterbotham, he exposed Bletchley's secret that they'd cracked Enigma, right?
Yeah, even in 1974, that was still a closely guarded secret, as they say. And so this guy came out and said, oh, we broke the German code. And not only that, but it came through completely clear that they were going to bomb Coventry and Churchill didn't do anything. And it's just not true. And then, surprise, two other people popped up with their own books making similar claims. But even their three conspiracy theories don't agree about how Churchill supposedly got this warning, when and from who.
Right. Okay. Now, there's also a play based on the theory, and it's called One Night in November. Let's listen to playwright Alan Pollock attacking Prime Minister Churchill.
The issue is not whether he knew, but why he did what he did. We know absolutely for a fact from the RAF report published 2 days after the raid that by 3 o'clock on the day, the German navigation beams were intercepting over Coventry and that the highest commands of the British establishment were put in the picture.
Now, if intercepted beams were the source of the intel, what did it have to do with Ultra, right?
Right.
In truth, the bombers didn't turn on the beams until as late as possible to avoid detection. And the first wave didn't follow the line precisely when they crossed into England for fear of what? They'd be intercepted. The Brits did try to jam the signals to send the enemy off course, but they failed.
Right. Again, from historic Coventry,
mm-hmm.
they talk about the different beams. They had extra-rat radio beams that were detected by our planes. This is them speaking. And the Germans would have been fully aware that the British could simply fly across the signal and detect these beams. They say, quote, "Therefore, Ultra was in no way compromised by letting the Germans find out that we were attempting to jam their signals," unquote. And one of Churchill's private secretaries, John Coville, wrote, again, another quote.
Mm-hmm.
And notice Winterbotham doesn't have any quotes, but we have tons of quotes.
Actual quotes. They live between these quotation marks, and they are meant to be a verbatim of what someone actually said.
Right. He said, quote, "All concerned with the information gleaned from the intercepted German signals were conscious that German suspicions must not be aroused for the sake of ephemeral advantages. In the case of the Coventry raid, no dilemma arose, for until the German directional beam was turned on the doomed city, nobody knew where the raid would be." Certainly the prime minister did not. And now while this guy, yes, he was loyal to Churchill, so maybe you could suspect he was covering something up. He wrote in his diary at the time, it's obvious some major air operation is on its way, but its exact destination the air ministry find difficult to determine. And there was just no reason to have this elaborate, I mean, they wouldn't have written anything, you would think.
Right.
According to war cabinet documents, the moment that the German radio beams made it clear that Coventry was the target, the air ministry ordered British bombers to strike the aerodrome south of Cherbourg, where the attackers were expected to launch from.
Right.
So the UK did act. It was just too little too late, and the Germans had a really good plan. You know, those Germans, they plan well. They were pioneers in aerial warfare.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Dean, at this point, what did Churchill learn from Ultra? What's the thought on this?
Well, there was all sorts of intelligence from many sources,
right,
as there always is in the intelligence community. And it's only in retrospect that you connect the dots. On November 12th, which is 2 days before the bombing, Dürkheims made clear that major German bombing run was imminent, but they gave no clue as the target. Air intelligence gave Churchill 5 possibilities for the raid that they expected.
Okay.
Central London, Greater London, the Thames Valley, or the Kent or Essex coasts.
Okay.
Now, there was a downed German pilot who suggested Coventry and Birmingham were going to take a hit, but unconnected with Moonlight Sonata. I mean, keep in mind, the Germans are bombing all the time. They're bombing the heck out of London and my mother.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that they thought that it pointed to London again, that was what the Germans at the time were trying to do. They thought if they could break London, they could break the lion's back, basically.
Right.
And so there were all these little pieces, and Churchill got this information, including a German map that marked 4 targeted areas all in the south, so not Coventry. Now, he read all this information the day of the attack after he returned from Neville Chamberlain's funeral, when I imagine he wasn't his best, but I don't think that really impacted at all.
Right.
It was just all what we call the fog of war, basically.
Yep. Now, Dean, with all the flak and the fighters, why didn't more bombers get shot down? I mean, I know it's sort of... It's almost a weird question to ask looking backward.
There just wasn't a developed air defense of the kind we have today. There are no surface-to-air missiles, radars in its infancy, and they just couldn't see them. All the usual countermeasures were prepared at all possible targets, including Coventry, the morning that they knew this big raid was coming or suspected it. But the intel summary predicted that the bombing would, quote, probably be in the vicinity of London. But if further information were made available to indicate Coventry, Birmingham, or elsewhere, they'd trust what they called their cold water countermeasures to respond. So they'd rush fire engines and civil defense to the area. So they had a plan. The Germans had a better plan,
right,
and they beat it.
They were a step ahead, and they destroyed the water. So,
yeah, they planned.
Yep, they sure did. Now here's one. So let's just say that Winston Churchill knew. Okay. Why would he have beefed up Coventry's defenses just a week before?
Yeah, if he was trying to, supposedly he didn't do anything because he didn't want to tip them off. But on November 7th, he gave orders to strengthen Coventry's air defenses. And that's a week before the raid. The city had 5 times as many anti-aircraft guns per head as London, which, you know, come to think of it, my mom might be upset about, but hey, I'm not going to complain.
Right.
Those 100 RAF fighters we talked about. But even with all that defense, the Nazis lost 1 bomber. And only 2 pilots actually opened fire because they were that hard to find. It's a big city. It's not as easy as what we see now when we go and stomp on some little second-rate country that's fighting with fighters that are 40 years earlier.
Right.
It's not Iron Eagle out there.
Doug, I ain't gonna make it.
These guys are just getting in boxes, flying up there and looking around in the night sky and having their view obscured by the moon, which is why the Germans chose it. And, you know, defense against night attacks at this point in history is just anti-aircraft guns and barrage balloons. And that's it. They haven't really organized the defense yet.
It is insane when you think about this.
Yeah, it is.
And that they held them off. I mean, they really ultimately held them off for so long
with
this primitive tech. I cannot wait to do a Battle of Britain show.
Yeah. And Terry Sharman, one last thing there from the Imperial War Museum. He said, even if you had put every air raid defense in the country around Coventry, it still would have been devastating. People prefer to think of things as a conspiracy, but even if Churchill had known on short notice, imagine the logistics of defending and evacuating a city the size of Coventry. Which makes sense. You said almost 250,000 people.
Right. I mean, that's nuts. That's nuts. See, this is what happened when England got rid of their dragons, you know? Shouldn't have done it.
I will rid the world of every last one of you.
I am the last one.
Dean, if nothing else, Coventry represents a real escalation when it comes to the targeting of civilians. Would you agree?
Yeah, they had pretty primitive guidance at the time, as you can imagine. I mean, these guys are only 15 years away from flying over in silk and wood planes and dropping the bombs out by hand and hoping they hit the right place. So it's not really advanced targeting. But nobody could have known in Britain at the time that this would be the moment that the bombing in their homeland expanded beyond this crude targeting of military assets. And I found this great clip of a Stuka pilot in 2010. This is Dr. Heinz Maygold.
The attack on Coventry was our first attack on also on a civilian target, which so far was avoided if at all possible. And the British had attacked at night with their old planes, Wellingtons, with the Wellingtons, Cologne, Berlin, several times. When I was in Berlin shortly for a mission, I was under such an attack. That means I was living far from the place where they were throwing, but they were throwing just into the town. And Adolf warned again. It was five times or so. He warned and warned. And then he did this retaliatory attack on Coventry. But there, in Coventry, it had also a military meaning, because in Coventry there were little factories or ateliers where flight instruments were fabricated around the cathedral. And there our bombers threw at night. And the aiming was rather modern for the time. And so they singled out these factories, but at the same time, they were also killing civilians, I think some 500 or so.
This is great, dude. He calls him Adolf.
Yeah.
His buddy, 2010.
It just seems so familiar.
It really does. Yeah. Well, as a, what was it from the producers? Hitler was a better dancer than Churchill. He wore better suits, told funnier jokes. He could have painted an entire apartment in one afternoon. Two coats! Sorry. It's not funny.
Not many people knew it, but the Führer was a terrific dancer.
Really? I never dreamed that...
That is because that you were taken in by the Allied propaganda!
Such filthy lies! They told lies!
But nobody ever said a bad word about Winston Churchill, did they?
What was Churchill doing on the day of the attacks?
That afternoon, Churchill was actually on his way out of London. He'd planned a trip there to just be out of the city and relax a little bit. John Martin, his principal private secretary, handed him a top secret message from C, which I think is awesome that the guy was just called C.
Quite Bondian.
Yeah. I'm not even going to tell you what his real name was because I want to maintain the secrecy.
But, but I see it right here. I want to say it. No, I won't say it. Go ahead.
Head of Secret Intelligence Services. And the message that Churchill read while he was driving was that Moonlight Sonata would target London.
Okay.
So Churchill told his driver, hey, return to number 10 Downing Street because I'm not going to spend a quiet night in the country while the capital is, quote, under heavy attack.
No.
So he went back home to number 10. He sent his secretaries to the underground shelter. And at this point, by the way, we're talking about male secretaries. So he sends them down into the shelters. He tells them, you're too young to die. Yeah, which must have been nice to hear your boss tell you.
Sure.
And he made sure his typists, known as the Garden Room Girls, were sent home for safety.
Okay.
He then went underground to the central war rooms, now known as the Churchill War Rooms, which is another really great place to visit for history in London. And he's down there and he's waiting and he's like, no bombs are going off. So he, quote, became so impatient that he spent most of his time on the Air Ministry roof waiting for Moonlight Sonata to begin. So he's waiting for the bombs to fall. Now, Pollock and other people who believe this want to say all of this is an elaborate acting job by Churchill and everybody around him. But there's really just nothing to back it up. It's completely undocumented, extremely unlikely. It's 34 years after the fact when the guy's trying to sell a book and he doesn't have any facts to base it on. When you have just so many question marks that don't fit, it just is not possible. I think the final word that I want to leave people with on this is from Richard Langworth, the former president of the Churchill Center and editor of The Finest Hour. I asked him how he'd sum up the Coventry deniers, and he emailed me back and he told me, quote, "Anybody who still thinks Churchill let Coventry burn to protect his secret intelligence in the light of all the evidence to the contrary, including the mustering of RAF fighters when the target was known, simply hasn't read the sources and is a victim of that electronic Hyde Park corner we call the internet."
Bravo, sir. Bravo, sir.
If you just take the time to read, you'll see it on your own. And if you just take the time to really think about it, it just doesn't make any sense, really. If Churchill was going to let the country be bombed, he probably would have just let somebody else be in charge and surrender. He wasn't a take a loss to win kind of guy.
But you can't expect anyone to go and read when they have to keep up with how many likes they have.
Yeah. You know? Well, it's a fun story. It's sexy. You know, we just like with the JFK Berlin quote and saying he said jelly donut, you know, when he only ran it by the mayor of Berlin, I think he would have told him if he did that, you know, "Hey, Mr. President, unless he wanted him to look like an idiot," which he clearly didn't.
Right.
You know, it's just, we love to look at a great man like Churchill, and he was great at so many things. You know, it makes us all feel so small. And so you like to say, "Oh, he did something bad and evil." See, he wasn't good.
Yeah.
But, you know, and he did do things that people can legitimately question, you know. Bombing the French fleet you mentioned last time, and the bombing of Dresden, which is another Churchill myth, actually, as far as it being related to Coventry. And so I think there's just that sense that we want to make them like us in ways that are negative instead of ways that are legitimate.
Sure.
When he wrote My Early Life, he wrote that book and he really talked down how he was as a student because he wanted kids that were reading it in Britain in those days in the 30s. He wanted them to have something to look up to. And he wanted to say, "Hey, see, I made it this far and I was just a lousy student and I didn't do this." And he plays down his life a lot because he did want to relate to people. But that's not something you can do for somebody.
No. It's true. It is true, true, true. Now, before we do leave, I want to suggest one thing, and call me a conspiracy theorist or just call me a knucklehead or a ninny, but I think I've discovered the true source of Churchill's greatness, and I think that comes from a very simple geographic reality that his mom is from Brooklyn.
That's true.
So that's it, and that's all I have to say on the subject. Goodbye! No.
And Pete, he's ripping off the headphones, folks. He's actually storing it.
Seriously, where do you want to leave folks with this, Dean?
I want to leave them with just the idea, go and read about it. The other people can only impugn everybody's motives, these people who believe this, or just say they haven't read it. But we're going to put a ton of links up there, and they're all different places. And ask yourself if all those piles upon piles of facts could possibly all be wrong, and one old man's recollection in the early 70s, and he was probably wearing bell bottoms. I can't believe a guy in bell bottoms.
He probably had polyester on. Exactly.
High on weed. I mean, come on. You've seen those pictures of Bin Laden from the 70s. It's a total schmuck. No wonder you got so mad all the time. And there are two history books I want to leave you with that George Washington University historian Christopher Sterling recommended to me when I was asking him about the key question of how can we as modern people get our minds around the fact that it was a turkey shoot for those German bombers and it was impossible to shoot any of them down. Basically, they got one. And he recommended two books about that. He recommended The Battle of Britain, Myth and Reality. That's the first book. And the second is The Battle of Britain, The Greatest Air Battle of World War II. So if you're looking to read more, again, go to all sorts of sources. Certainly go to the Churchill Center, winstonchurchill.org, and learn about what happened. And the next time you see or hear somebody say the wrong thing about Coventry and claim this lie about Churchill, stand up for him, because he was there standing up for us all those years of the war, and he saved the world.
He did indeed. All right. Hey, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
Thank you for being here for another episode of Angry History.
To this desolation comes King George, with sympathy and inspiration for the stricken community. Despite the loss of homes and loved ones, the courageous townsfolk show their ruler that Coventry, like London, can take it.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.